Here I am, along with Jennifer Willett. What a very pleasing lady indeed. I have thought for a very long time that there's a possibility that one day some scientist somewhere, I'm sure that black holes are going to be fine and we get the right accelerator, we'll create one and it'll just go and the world will be well. But someday I worry that some scientist somewhere on the edge, the cutting edge of some science, is going to push a button and there's going to be a lot more than a little pop. We'll be right back. Jennifer, is there any reason to worry that that could happen? That one day some scientist will push a button on the cutting edge of something and get a reaction that we all will dislike?
Well, it's funny because every time a new machine opens up, this sort of question comes up. I mean, it's been happening since like the 1950s. It certainly happened when Fermilab opened up. Everyone was terrified they were going to create a supernova. With the LHC, it's all about the mini black holes. The key word here is mini. I mean, mini doesn't quite get it across. They're literally going to be indistinguishable from subatomic particles, and they're going to last just about that long. I don't know, you're probably very familiar with Stephen Hawking's theory of black holes. It turns out that they do emit little bits of radiation. Essentially, this is called Hawking radiation, and it causes them to gradually evaporate. They basically lose mass. The radiation comes from the black hole losing mass, and over time it evaporates. And how fast it evaporates depends on how big it is. A really big, massive rotating black hole at the center of one of the galaxies, it's going to take billions of years. But something the size of a subatomic particle, it's going to be there for such a short amount of time that we won't even know we've seen it. They actually think they might have seen one at Brookhaven. They have a machine there called the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, but it lasted so short that all they really got was some data in the form of a lot of squiggly lines, and they're really debating whether or not it's a black hole, a mini black hole or not. So in general, when scientists talk about probabilities, they always say, well, if you press them, they'll say there's, a tiny, tiny chance. But they really mean a tiny, tiny chance. They mean that basically over the entire history of the universe, maybe just a little bit beyond the end of our universe, if we waited that long, we might have something really dangerous, which means that there's really no real danger from the LHC. They can't rule it out. No honest scientist will rule it out completely because probabilities being what they are, scientists never close the book, on anything really.
Yeah, I'm not saying it won't happen. But the other day here in Pahrump, Nevada, at one of the casinos, somebody won $18 million on a penny machine.
Yeah.
So
Well,
eventually,
yeah. But
eventually.
to give you, that's actually a very, very good analogy. Yeah, they might have won $18 million, but in order for, say, something that could consume the world be produced at one of these hadron colliders, they would have to have that happen roughly 20 times in a row.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll rest
And
easy.
I'm being generous.
Okay.
When
I'll
we're talking
relax a
about
little bit.
probabilities and odds, that's the kind of probabilities we're talking about. So I'm not losing a lot of sleep over the mini
All
black
right.
hole
Well,
scenario.
maybe I saw The Stand too recently. Have you ever seen
Yeah. I'm
that?
not familiar with The Stand. Everybody I know raves about it.
Basically, at the beginning of it said, this is the way the world ends. And, somebody in a lab dropped a test tube full of some sort of horrible designer killing virus flu type thing, and that was it.
Well, did the world end or did humanity get wiped out? I mean, there's a difference.
Well, you had to have a story, so they couldn't totally wipe out humanity.
Right.
And of course, there was some continuation, but basically, most everybody died. And certainly a virus could potentially achieve that.
Yes, a flu pandemic could achieve that. A virus could achieve it. Biological warfare could achieve it. A nuclear bomb, if we set off several at once, could almost wipe out the human race by bringing on nuclear winter. We could certainly make our planet uninhabitable for us. But
I wonder if we're doing that now.
there's some good evidence for that.
Are you on with the group? It seems that science has not quite closed ranks, but just about has closed ranks on this whole global warming thing.
Right. I mean, there's still a few random scientists who are kind of casting doubt on it, but I think there's a pretty strong consensus. When you've got, you know, thousands of scientists all the world over, you know, coming up and saying, well, you know, basically, you know, this is happening. There is a slight increase in terms of the Earth's overall temperature, and it does seem to be coming from man-made processes. I'm going to kind of go with the consensus on that. It's just you know, there's just a preponderance of evidence there that, you know, after a certain point, you can't ignore it. You can sit there and poke holes in some of the methodologies, but they've been doing that for quite some time, and I think you're right. I think there is a very strong consensus at this point.
When you look at the North Pole 40 or 50 years ago, and you look at it now, it looks like about 40% of it has melted. Now, when 40% of the North Pole melts, when they're getting ready to navigate across the new sea that is going to be there instead of ice, it just seems like that is going to have a big impact somehow or another on the world.
Yeah. I've seen pictures before and after of the North Pole, and it's terrifying.
It really is. And the ice sheets down south don't look all that stable. They're beginning to talk about them beginning to break up in cracks they didn't know were there. And, of course, if the Ross ice should melt, there'd be quite a change in sea level.
Yeah, there would. I mean, I've actually seen, you know, schematics of, say, New York City, you know, under, like, several feet of water. And, you know, basically, you know, half the California coast would be underwater and things like that. Yeah, they're definitely, I mean, obviously these are models and these are worst case scenarios, but it's definitely a possibility. And regardless of whether or not you think that worst case scenario is going to transpire, I think it's very obvious that we need to do something to at least stem the tide a little bit. And it really, you know, we're past the point where we can ignore it and pretend that it's not happening.
Well, in our generation, I guess we can say we'll be all right. But I'm not sure about our children. And then there's this trigger thing where it kind of feeds on itself. I worry about that one. You've heard about that, right?
Yeah, I have.
The more ice it melts, the more water you have, the more absorption you have, and the more ice you've got melting and so forth and so on.
Yeah, and it just speeds up. It goes faster and faster.
Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, it would seem the
weather is changing.
Yeah. It's funny because people, every time it gets hot, people think that, you know, there, global warming is true, and then we get a cold snap like we've had recently, and everybody thinks that, therefore, it's bunk. And I think it's a misunderstanding of what we mean by climate change.
Yeah.
But we're going to definitely get more extreme weather patterns, I think.
I've got this really interesting story from Britain. They've had a pretty good snowstorm over there. And they're teaching the people in Britain about snow, for example, how to make snowballs. And really cute. Anyway, it does look like it's changing. And that brings me back to Mr. Bigelow and Michio Kaku, who think that eventually we're going to need to be able to get off this planet. And we sure don't seem to be moving very much in that direction. We went to the moon and then gave up.
Yeah, it's like kind of been there, done that. And as far as I can see, there's really no plans for manned missions to Mars. And that, I mean, NASA's really kind of been, in terms of their manned spaceflight program, has really kind of been hurting in recent years. It's all been on unmanned exploration. I love Mars Rover. I love the pictures that have come back.
Oh, me too.
But I'm kind of wondering why we haven't gone back. You know.
Well, they announced President Bush announced that we would go back to the moon and then didn't fund it. And if you look at the amount of funding for NASA as compared to the years when we went to the moon, it is just a tiny fraction of what we had. So we're not going back to the moon.
Probably not. No, not with the way the current funding levels are going. But, you know, all of science is suffering in that respect.
Good point.
I mean, Brookhaven was almost had to shut down because of there was budget problems in Congress. And they were kind of saved at the last minute. But that's the second time in the year, second year in a row, that they've come like this close to having to shut down for 6 months. And that's a major physics facility. That's right here on Earth. So obviously going to the moon is just not high on anyone's priority when things like that are so pressing.
And we're not really pointing our children toward science anymore, or they don't want to be pointed toward science. I'm not sure what's going on, but in America, science sure is taking a back seat, and it scares me to death.
Yeah, it's like they want all the benefits of science. They want their iPods and their Blackberries, but they don't actually want to know anything about how it works. And eventually that's going to, you know, come back and bite us in the butt, because, you know, we're not going to have that next generation of brilliant scientists if we don't really start encouraging people. And that includes, you know, women, you know, as we were talking at the beginning of the show. I mean,
yes.
We've really got to start drawing in all kinds of expertise, different ways of thinking, different ways of approaching old problems.
Well, I hope something is done. Unfortunately, we get the iPods, we get the new technology. Most times we invent it here, and then it's refined and produced elsewhere and sent back to us, contributing
right.
to the imbalance of our, you know, our budget.
Right.
Well, nevertheless, here you are. So, tell me about the Buffyverse. In what way are physics different?
Well, I always say that, you know, the Buffyverse has the one thing that, you know, we don't have, and that's like a huge amount of, you know, extra energy of a very special kind. It's kind of this extra mystical energy. You seem very, you know, literate in your advanced physics, and you know that a lot of the problems with things like creating wormholes and closed time-like curves and some of these really, you know, advanced exotic, you know, permutations of space-time are really energy problems.
Right.
And that is not the case in the Buffyverse. You do get closed time-life curves. You do get time folding back on itself, portals opening up all over the place. So at least some of that energy is negative energy. And you have other dimensional worlds. So the things that we can only dream about and theorize and hypothesize about in our world are actually very real in the Buffyverse. And it's all done in this kind of very fun, you know, monsters, good versus evil kind of, you know, superhero fight, but the physics there is actually quite advanced and quite interesting.
I wonder if there really could be such a universe. I guess the answer is there could be.
Right, we just never know about it. Absolutely there could be, you know, but since they're not allowed to interact, we wouldn't be able to know. I mean, how do we know there isn't like a little baby universe somewhere that has these things in existence? So
we don't. And
we
maybe
don't.
If somebody writes about them, they pop into place.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. There's a writer that does that, Fictons.
Oh, there you go.
Is it Robert Heinlein? I can't remember which writer it is. But basically a sci-fi writer came up with this idea that, you know, basically every book, every fiction that's created has its own little universe. And at some point, they all start traveling and visiting each other's books. It's kind of amusing. I like
the idea
a lot.
So do I. When I asked Michio Kaku, Dr. Kaku, about time travel and other universes, he suggested that the answer to time travel and any possible problems associated with time travel, paradoxes and such, would be that when you go back and kill your grandfather, a new universe is instantly created, one in which everything unfolds in a perfectly proper manner.
Mm-hmm. That's not a new idea. It's actually kind of interesting, and it's actually a feature of the Buffyverse and a lot of other examples of science fiction. These kind of alternate realities that happen. It dates back to the 1950s and a guy named Hugh Everett III. If you know your quantum mechanics, you know about the Schrodinger's cat paradox. How can a cat
yes.
be both dead and alive? You have that
right.
superposition of states. Open the box, you look, the wave function collapses, and it becomes either dead or alive. Everett wanted to know, well, what happens to the other possibilities? And he decided that for every single possibility, every choice, every irreversible event that takes place, a new universe is created so that all the possibilities exist simultaneously somewhere. There's some real philosophical problems with that right off the bat, which is, you know, if you do that for everything right down to the subatomic level, you've just got billions upon billions, an infinite number of universes. But it's a nice idea.
I struggle, Jennifer, with quantum mechanics. And,
we all do.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a communications guy. All my life I've been in radio, one way or the other, ham radio, you know, commercial mm-hmm. broadcasting, radio. And to me, particles separated have to, in some manner, communicate with each other. They have to. There has to be some kind of communication that's exceeding light, right?
I don't.
Wrong.
That's one of those really fine distinctions that I don't quite get about quantum mechanics, but it's wrong because I've had it explained to me about 8 million times, and like you, I struggle with it because, you know, it does seem like that should be happening, but I tend to view it as kind of, rather than having information traveling faster than the speed of light, that that's actually not the way it works. It's more like a logical deduction. You know, there's actually no information being sent, but, you know, if you have two particles and you split them and one is red and one is green and you know that starting out, then you look at your particle and it's red, you know without any information going anywhere that the other one must be green.
Yeah.
You know?
I know,
I understand what you're saying. I mean, quantum mechanics is weird, and those little nuances are really important, and they're very, very hard for some of us non-scientists to get our heads around. And that's one of them. That's a real big sticking point.
They've attempted communication through quantum mechanics, and it's never worked. In other words, you should be able to, you know, somehow send a message using quantum mechanics, but the answer is no, right?
No, they can't send a message. They have been able to, quote-unquote, teleport particles, but it's not the way that we would conceive of teleportation on Star Trek. What happens is the original particle is, you know, when you scan it, you essentially destroy it. And then you have to kind of do this little tricky thing with entanglement so that basically you create a new particle, an entirely new particle in a new location. They've actually done it, you know, over, you know, several kilometers. I mean, and they've done it with like clouds of atoms over a few feet. They've actually done some really amazing things with little clouds of particles through this little method. But they can only do it once, because you destroy the original particle, and they have not been able to encode any kind of information on those particles. These are those nuances that, you know, that we all get hung up on.
And science wants things that are utterly repeatable.
Oh, absolutely. It's not useful to us if we can't encode information and then have it like work over and over again. You need a certain robustness in any kind of system for it to be useful at all.
Why was Star Trek so seemingly accurate, so far ahead of its time?
Well, I'm not sure it was particularly far ahead of its time. I mean, the creator, Gene Roddenberry, was actually very plugged into the physics community, and he was very intrigued by some of the stuff that at the time were kind of notions that were being bandied about but that we had no evidence for, black holes being one of them. For a long time, we didn't think black holes could exist. We thought they were entirely theoretical, and then in the 90s, we realized, hey, there they are, which should give us hope for things like string theory. You know?
Sure.
You know, because there's a lot of ideas that, you know, turned out to be true. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily that Star Trek got it right, but that Roddenberry was plugged in with the scientific community that got it right.
Well, they sure did.
Yeah.
Things that are yet ahead of us, some things that have already occurred, and many that are obviously fairly close, I guess, or now being more than just imagined a little bit.
Right. Well, I mean, we can't actually afford to do something like the holodeck, but we can do some amazing things with holograms. So that alone is huge.
Are quantum computers eventually going to be able to create that kind of a world, do you think?
I'm not sure if it's really a question of processing power, which I think is the main advantage of quantum computing. You get like very, very rapid parallel processing so you can solve things. Computers are always going to be kind of limited. This gets back to the question of consciousness and things like that.
Right. In fact, that was going to be my next question. Is artificial intelligence, is that going to be part of the quantum world? In other words, at some point, is it a matter of storage? Is it a matter of processor speed? What is it?
Well, I think until we figure out what human consciousness is, we can't even begin to emulate it. And that's still very much an area of debate. I mean, everything I've read on AI, they're still arguing with each other over what constitutes artificial intelligence. It certainly isn't something as simple as the Turing test. John Searle's famous Chinese room paradox seems to be very overly simplistic. Daniel Dennett has some very interesting ideas on it, but again, those are also, you know, quite controversial. I think until they find some sort of consensus on what it is and how they're going to define it and get a little bit more understanding of how our brains work, I don't think we have any chance. There's something
Jennifer,
just
hold it right
different.
There. We're at a break. I have to break here. We'll be right back. Here I am. Let me set this up a little. I'm well aware that we're all traveling in time. We're all moving along at exactly the speed of time, right? So we're traveling in time from the present into the future. We're constantly doing that. I'm also aware that if we fire ourselves off in a rocket and go light years out and come back, we have essentially traveled in time. But I'm eternally curious whether, save those two possibilities, time travel will ever be possible. I speak now of a machine with levers and knobs and probably lots of energy that'll take us backward in time or into the future. In a moment, we'll ask. Okay, Jennifer, a time machine.
Ah. Well, you know, I'm as fascinated by time travel as you are, but we're not going to get Doctor Who's TARDIS anytime soon. But I actually do love the idea of being able to travel, you know, back in time. You had talked about, you know, special relativity and how if you travel faster and faster, you can actually travel into the future.
Do you have a cell phone?
No, I don't.
That sound that we're hearing, do you hear that?
Yeah, I heard it just briefly, and I don't know what that is.
That's a cell phone processor. Somebody is close to some piece of critical equipment between you and I with a cell phone.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
sorry
proceed.
About that.
Proceed.
In terms of traveling back in time, unless you can travel faster than the speed of light, you know, which is impossible, you know, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, you can't go back in time. General relativity actually does allow for the, you know, theoretical possibility that if you have sufficient energy or mass, you could actually bend space-time sufficiently so that a point in the future could, like, fold over and touch a point in the past. They're called closed time-like curves. And I love this because it also takes care of, you essentially create like a time loop, kind of like what happens in Groundhog Day.
All right.
Where you just keep repeating the same day over and over again. what I like about that, I mean, the way it's portrayed in Hollywood, there's always some person who remembers, who's aware that this is happening. In an actual closed time-like curve, you're actually constantly traveling forward in time, and yet somehow you keep ending up in the past. The same place where it touches over and over and over again.
Right.
It actually solves the problem of, without having to create alternate realities, it solves the problem of, can you go back and kill your own grandfather? And the answer is no, because there's only a certain point to which you can go, and if you're not aware of it, you can't actually change the outcome of events. You just constantly replay that chain of events.
So that could, it's within the realm.
Well, you need a lot of energy, like all the energy in the entire universe and possibly a little more.
Oh.
I know, it's a daunting challenge. But they do have, and there's papers every year about this, about whether time travel is possible. The most recent one has to do with kind of like this donut-shaped configuration. It's basically a wormhole version of a closed time-like curve where basically you just travel in a spiral inside this little donut-shaped thing, and then the more closer you get to the hole, the further back in time you go.
That's actually being worked on.
That is actually being worked on by theoretical physicists. I'm not making that up.
Oh, no, it is. It is. I interviewed a man who's working on that, and if he gets the funding, he's going to actually give it a shot.
Which would be very interesting to see.
Yes, it would.
I'd like to know where he's going to get the energy. If they can figure out how to do that, that would be great, I think.
It would be incredible. It would open up so much. Is there anything in the interview that we have not yet covered that you would enjoy covering? Anything that I missed? There's a lot here.
Yeah, there kind of is, although we covered some of the big ones. No, I think we've pretty much covered it. I'm actually quite interested in sound. In fact, my third book is probably going to be about that.
Really?
Recently, I've gotten very, very interested in a phenomenon known as infrasound. I mean, we're all familiar with ultrasound. It's used for imaging. It can actually, you know, stop bleeding in accident victims and break up kidney stones and things like that. Infrasound is kind of really low frequencies that we can't hear, that aren't aware of. Certain animals use it to communicate, like manatees and elephants. What I found intriguing is that even though we can't hear it, sound is mechanical energy, and we are often kind of aware of infrasound, and that many scientists think that it actually explains the whole sensing a ghostly presence phenomenon. There's a very famous tale. A guy's actually doing research on this, and it's from 1998, I believe, where he actually saw a ghost. He felt the prickling on the back of his neck, and he saw a ghost. And it turned out to be infrasound at a certain frequency resonates with the natural frequency of the eye and basically causes you to hallucinate, causes an optical illusion. And the brain tries to make sense of that by creating this, like, visual illusion. I think that's actually very interesting. That's almost cooler than ghosts being
real.
So
there goes the ghosts.
There goes the ghosts. I know, yeah. But you know, if it's replaced by something that's as cool as that, you know, I'm willing to let ghosts go. I love a good ghost story as much as anyone, but that's a really, really wonderful explanation. I'm really pleased that there's research going in on that.
Let me go back to ultrasound for a moment, because
sure.
I've got a little baby girl, even at my age, on the way.
Oh, wow.
And we really recently did an ultrasound, and oh my God, have they come a long way with ultrasound.
Did you get the 3D one?
Yes, we did.
Oh, those are
3D in color.
Those are art.
And yes, now how is that done? I can only imagine that the difference in infinitesimal difference in the return of the sound must produce the difference, must produce the three-dimensional effect. That's just a guess.
It's actually in the way they process it. The computers have gotten so good that they can actually take signals coming, you know, basically the way ultrasound creates images, it bounces the signals off and then uses that data to construct an image. They've gotten to the point where they can get such precise information and such precise resolution that they can reconstruct computationally this 3D image.
Okay, is that done by measuring, in other words, if the hand is, let's say, 3 inches farther away from the originating sound than, I don't know, the belly,
well,
then you can show the hand is down with respect to the belly.
You should be able to, I would assume. But generally, the way ultrasound is, you know, they basically, you know, do it right on the skin so that you don't actually have that happen. You don't have that kind of interference. It's really in how they process the incoming data. They get much higher, much more precise information, and they're able to therefore get a much higher resolution image and then create that sort of 3D effect. It's beautiful. I'm so thrilled you got that.
It's astounding. I sat there with my jaw on my chest. It was just amazing.
It just makes it real, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And so you've got another book coming out, and it's about sound, and you think that might explain ghosts, huh?
Oh, well, I think it's a very intriguing idea. I haven't actually started the third book yet, but there's definitely going to be a chapter on infrasound, because I'm, you know, not only does it explain ghosts, but it turns out that we can actually use it to learn a little bit more about the behavior of volcanoes and tornadoes and various natural phenomena.
Really?
There's apparently a whole, you know, infrasound is everywhere. I like to
define infrasound for me, please.
Infrasound is essentially just it's basically a sound wave. It's just at a very, very low frequency. I think the frequency for the ghostly phenomenon is like 18.98 hertz, well below what human beings can hear. But apparently we are still subliminally kind of aware of it. I mean, because it's a mechanical energy, because it is vibrating around us. You know, we do pick up on it subconsciously.
That's not all that far from Schumann frequency, right?
I'm not sure what Schumann frequency is.
That's an Earth frequency or something,
yes.
Down around?
The Earth frequency is probably a little bit lower than that even, but certainly volcanoes are, you know, do have that infrasonic frequency, and that's related to the Earth frequency. And they can actually tell when they're getting ready to erupt by studying the infrasound and some of the patterns that emerge. Essentially, volcanoes moan when they're getting ready to erupt, like they have like a stomach ache or something.
Huh. Fascinating.
Yeah,
and
I've heard sound samples of it. It's really creepy sounding.
So there's something in our brains that resonates with those frequencies.
At certain frequencies, yes. There's something about that 18.98. They think it's basically the natural resonant frequency of the optic nerve or the eyeball. Mm-hmm. So what basically that it's the mechanical vibration coming in from the sound actually stimulates that and will cause these sensations. It doesn't do it in everybody, which I think is kind of interesting. Some people are more sensitive than others, which would certainly explain why some people think they're psychic and other people think they're crazy.
Does science explain everything? For example, I interview people, Jennifer, that have died, mm-hmm. and they come back with impossible stories of the kind of treatment they were getting, the things that were said by the physicians and EMT people that were treating them while they were dead,
mm-hmm.
clinically dead. No
right.
heartbeat, no respiration, nothing. But they come back and tell people what was said and what was done. And then they also tell these stories about, you know, the white light and the relatives and all the rest of that.
Yeah, I haven't actually looked deeply into that, but I did read a very interesting science fiction novel a few years ago by Connie Willis called Passages. She really does very well in terms of coming up with real science. And a lot of it has to do with biochemical impulses and electrical impulses in the brain. The neurons basically die very, very slowly. And essentially, these things are like SOS symbols, these SOS signals to the brain, basically trying to kickstart it and reboot the system. I can't speak for them being aware of what was going around them when they were supposedly brain dead. Again, this gets back to we really don't understand much about how we're getting that sound.
Yeah, there it is. That's somebody's cell phone.
Well, it's
that's
not,
very interesting.
It's not mine. I'm really.
I left mine in the other room for exactly that reason.
Oh.
But it may be one of our board ops or somebody at the network with a cell phone. And,
okay, because
that's very interesting.
Mine's in the other room as well. Weird radio waves. Weird things happen.
yeah, they do. But I recognize that particular pattern, and that's from a cell phone processor.
Right.
Anyway, so these frequencies may explain a lot.
I think they may. I mean, we're just beginning to kind of, you know, investigate infrasound. People have known about it for a very long time. We're to the point now where our instruments are extremely sensitive and scientists can actually really get down to the nitty-gritty and study these things in depth and, you know, how it works. And the more we know about how the brain works, of course, which we don't know very much at all.
How come?
It's just really hard to study it. It's a very complex thing. It's hard to image it. It's hard to, even with, you know, more advanced technologies like fMRI, it's just very, very difficult to see what's going on in there because these things happen so fast and all that electrical activity is really hard to track.
I've actually heard, Jennifer, that there have been people in accidents that, for example, have lost up to half their brain or more and continue to function fairly normally.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I haven't actually, you know, don't have any evidence for that, but I mean, I've definitely heard it. And you know, it can happen. I mean, the body can adapt in some really amazing ways sometimes. I mean, I've heard of people getting brain damage in one area and actually another part of their brain will step in and try and make up the difference. Certainly, we know that when people lose a limb, their bodies adapt. It's just, you know, it takes some time for the brain to kind of retrain and for the motor impulses to retrain. But the body is an amazingly adaptable machine.
So you dismiss then most of a great deal of what we talk on this about on this program, people who have the ability to, I'm going to come right back to something that I wish I wasn't coming back to, but I have to because it was my experience. I had an experience of a precognition, Jennifer. There's no question about it. I'm not going to bore everybody by repeating it, but I saw something ahead of time that was going to happen to my car. It came washing over me in waves and waves and waves, telling me it was going to happen. And sure enough, 5 or 10 minutes into this undeniable wave after wave of forcing me to go look at my car, I went out there and watched a guy get in his car, put it in reverse, and smack into my car. And it so disoriented me when it actually happened that I fell to my knees, got back up, opened the sliding door, and said, "Hey, I saw that." He stopped. We talked. It was okay. But mm-hmm. he hit my car.
Yeah.
And I knew he was going to hit my car.
You know, it's funny because I think every single one of us has had something like that happen, where we just felt the inevitability of something, and then it happened. I'd be very careful of saying that I dismiss things that you normally talk about on your show. I would just not ascribe it to magic. To me, the world is not magic. The world is more wonderful than magic. Just because we can't explain it now doesn't mean we won't be able to explain it, because after all, things like radio waves, you know, if you took a radio back, you know, 1,000 years, people would think it was demon-possessed.
No, I don't call it magic. I call it precognition, and it absolutely happened, period. It just happened. Now, it's never happened again. I couldn't make it happen if I wanted to. I didn't want it to happen when it did, but it happened.
Uh-huh.
Now,
I don't have an answer for that. I mean, a very good friend of mine, you know, believes that she's psychic. I would say that she's extremely intuitive and very good at reading people. But again, I mean, these are things we don't actually, you know. These are the kinds of mysteries about how the brain works that, you know, I hope that one day we'll be able to explain.
Well, it's not repeatable, so it's not science.
It's very tough. To repeat something like that.
But I can assure you it was real.
I have no doubt about it, because, I mean, we've all experienced something like that where, you know, we just kind of felt, okay, this was going to happen, and then it did.
This was way beyond that.
Pardon?
It was way beyond that, Jennifer. It was wave after wave after wave hitting me like monster ocean waves crashing on me. I was angry at it. I was watching TV at the time. And so I got up and I went over and I looked at my car and it was fine. And I said, what a bunch of so-and-so. Sat back down, watched the news, and the waves started coming again, even stronger. Uh-huh. To the point where I finally had to get up again, stood in the window, watched the guy walk down the sidewalk, get in his car, put it in reverse, and hit my car. Now, that wasn't subtle.
No. Although I'm curious why it was your car.
I don't know.
So.
I don't know.
Do you love your car?
I didn't. No, I don't. Cars are useful. I don't. No, not
yeah.
No.
Well, it's a very interesting, you know, story. But like, as you said, it's irreproducible, so there's no way you can test it or do anything, you know, to repeat that. So, you know, it's hard to put that into the realm of science. But I wouldn't call it magic either. You know, it's just something we cannot yet explain.
But it's real. So that means that there are things out there that are not just 18.79 or whatever?
18.98 hertz,
thank you. In other words, not everything can be explained by some sort of science.
I think it can, maybe not the science we have today, but I'm not backing down on that.
No, huh?
Well, I was a late convert to science, but I think it's a really great way of looking at the world, because it does insist, you know, on testing and reproducibility and things like that, because the human brain, we're pretty good at fooling ourselves. I'm really good at wishful thinking. I'm really good at tricking myself into thinking something must be true because I want it to be true, and science keeps me honest.
Mm-hmm. It's just that science is so cocksure about things, and, you know, I just know that some of these other things are true, and one day you're going to... I mean, every day, Jennifer, I see stories, AP stories and so forth, some scientists saying, we previously thought so such and such was true, but today, science learned that, well, so-and-so is true. So they're backing down all the time.
Well, that's the nature of science. I think people, you know, your statement that, you know, I think scientists sometimes come off as cocksure, but in fact, the nature of science is exploration. Even something as, you know, they're very, very sure about the second law of thermodynamics. They're pretty, that has yet to be violated and, you know, and that sort of thing, but they're still testing it. They're not pouring a lot of money into it, but they still admit that the possibility that somewhere along the line, E equals MC squared might be violated, you know, entropy might be violated. They do test these things. It's the nature of science to change, to progress, and that what we once believed, we want to move forward.
I've got it. All right. Listen, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll open the lines for Jennifer Ouellette. I'm Art Bell.